It's been about 2 decades since the opioid epidemic first exploded across Appalachia, and now doctors are shifting away from prescribing opioids for long-term pain. On today's show, we'll hear one man's struggle with addiction as a way to self-medicate.
When I was away from my family, it was, a lot of times I would do pills just to take my mind off that.
Overcoming opioid addiction often means learning to cope with emotional and mental pain, as well as physical pain.
They also use it to treat the emotional pain because it numbs the entire brain. It's not selective. It numbs the entire brain.
Addicts and doctors weigh in on why addiction hit Appalachia so hard, and we'll hear what solutions the medical community is implementing to fight the pain pill epidemic. That's coming up in this week's episode of Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Back in April, we aired a special report about the opioid epidemic here in Appalachia. And just recently, President Trump's Commission on the Opioid Crisis recommended that the president declare the opioid crisis a national public health emergency. The commission said that such a declaration could free up money to fight the epidemic. So this week, we're going to revisit this story to remember how some Appalachians became addicted and what a battle for sobriety can be like. Last summer, the Centers for Disease Control announced new guidelines for treating chronic pain, recommending doctors shouldn't prescribe opioids as a first choice for patients suffering from chronic pain. The recommendations are voluntary for doctors, and they don't apply for cancer patients or people undergoing end-of-life care. But it does signal a shift in the way the medical community is approaching pain management. Instead of prescribing opioids, the CDC says doctors should first try to encourage their patients to do physical therapy, yoga, chiropractic, or exercise therapy for their long-term chronic pain. That's because studies have found that 1 in 4 patients receiving long-term opioid therapy in primary care settings struggle with opioid use disorder. But this shift away from pills has met resistance from some doctors and patients. In today's show, we'll explore the story of those who became addicted to pain pills after their doctors prescribed opioids. And we'll hear doctors explain how we got here, why treating pain without causing addiction isn't always easy. After all, pain, unlike blood pressure or temperature, is virtually impossible to measure. We start with the story of a man who knows personally what it's like to struggle with addiction after being prescribed painkillers for a hand injury. Michael Holdren works 2 jobs to support his 4 children and pay for his house and 2 cars. He's taken Suboxone for 2.5 years to control his addiction. Like many addicts, his problem started with an injury while working a physically demanding job on an oil rig in Pennsylvania.
I was working in the oil field, and I had my hand broke with a sledgehammer. My driller broke my hand with a sledgehammer. My driller boss, he's the boss. Okay. We was putting a flow line together, and he didn't see my hand there, and he hit my hand with the sledgehammer. And I went for like 3 days without going to the hospital. They're going to make fun of you if you go to the doctor kind of thing. You know, you just tough it out and stick through the day because there's only 4 guys at work, and if I left, I'd leave them shorthanded. But finally, I did go to the hospital, and it was broken in like 4 places. And by that time, my hand swelled up to here, and I'm out there working and stuff. And then I went to the hospital. They gave me pain pills, and that's where it started. So I had more energy when I was working, and I felt better and everything. And then next thing I know, I have all this money, and I can't get a prescription from a doctor, but I can go buy them because I have money. So that's where it started, and that's not where it got bad, but that's right where it started.
Michael was basically living in a hotel so he could work. He says he rarely saw his wife and children, so he got lonely.
Which I was always by myself on oil rigs anyway. So I'd work 8 days by myself and live in a hotel. You know, I was always alone without my family. I mean, I had my friends and everything there, but when I was away from my family, it was, a lot of times I would do pills just to take my mind off that.
Michael says that many of his co-workers on the oil rig were on drugs. He admits that even before he was prescribed painkillers because of his work injury, he was snorting or inhaling methamphetamine. After he got his first legal prescription, he doctor shopped, which means he got another prescription for pain pills from another doctor for the same injury.
Gave me a prescription. I took it. It was gone 2 days. I got to go home like 2 days later after that. I cut my cast off, went to a hospital in Charleston, got another. I said, I think my hand's broke, and they did an x-ray, and they gave me another prescription because they didn't know about the one in Pennsylvania. I could go anywhere if I had the money and get anything I want. Okay. Anything. I mean, even from doctors. I know doctors would just take cash for, you know, a prescription. And they'll write you a prescription, and you'll go do your pills, and then you're hooked. And it's not easy because once you're addicted to it, your life is completely different than it was. Like, you live for that pill. You live for that drug. You live for everything that you're not supposed to live for. I mean, this is not something I just picked up and just started doing because I wanted to do it. This is something that I did, and I just couldn't stop doing. And I had no control over it. None. And that's the way it is for a lot of people. You don't have control over this. My ex-wife, she thought that I was out cheating on her because I was lying and I was sneaking around, but I was only lying and sneaking around to go get drugs. I always tell my wife that I made less than I did just so I'd have that extra little bit of money for pills. So I'd pay my bills and I would spend the rest on pills. And then it got to the point where I wasn't paying my bills, even with all the money I had. I wasn't paying my bills. It was all going to pain pills.
His wife filed for divorce, which Michael says was devastating at the time.
Yeah, that really, when that all that happened, it made it a lot worse. Because she left, I didn't think I had anything to live for. So, with my kids gone, her gone, and me by myself, I just given up. And that was the only thing that made me feel good. I thought that that was the only thing that made me feel good. Thinking about it now, my kids are my everything. Everything. But then, I wasn't thinking like that. I was thinking, oh, I gotta have this, or just everything's gonna be over today.
I found that the people who are addicted that I've worked with in a treatment setting are extremely intelligent. They are very bright people. These are very creative people. They have talent. They can sing. They can play a musical instrument. They can draw. I mean, they are very gifted.
That's Janice Lalos, director of the Charleston Comprehensive Treatment Center in West Virginia. It's an outpatient substance abuse treatment program that also offers medication-assisted treatment, also known as MAT, which means they can provide methadone, Suboxone, Subutex, and Vivitrol to patients addicted to opioids. These medications help patients to reduce their craving for opioids, which allows them to remain in and benefit from treatment. Patients are required to attend weekly individual and group therapy from counselors at the treatment center.
You know, these are not just do-less people who sit on the couch. These are people who can change the world. So, you know, you really have to watch because those are the superstar people that we would want to see do great things. And these seem to be the people that are somehow, for whatever reason, affected by addiction.
And treating addiction means helping people cope with whatever mental or emotional issues may have led to the addiction in the first place. That includes working with psychologists like Catherine Sayre, who manages the medically assisted treatment program at the Charleston Center.
The therapy component is the most important, the behavioral health part of it.
Sayre has been a licensed psychologist in West Virginia since 1999. She says while the medicine treats the symptoms, therapy is the important aspect for recovery.
Because addiction is not just about putting a substance in your body. Addiction is also about all the behaviors that go along with putting that substance into your body. People use these substances not only to deal with physical pain, they use it to deal with emotional pain, mental pain. They lose the ability to cope with normal everyday stressors, things that you or I, you know, the car breaks down. you or I know what we need to do, they don't have a lot of coping skills. So what we're trying to do is help them learn different coping skills so that when the medication is gone, when they finally titrate off the medication, they have a whole box of tools so they can go out into the community, continue to live their life without needing to go back to an addictive substance to cope.
Most psychologists agree that opioid addiction is a mental health illness, that once someone is addicted, they'll always have that addiction for their entire life. Getting clean usually means learning to cope with the disease of addiction. It's not just about detoxing. This is likely why so many opioid addicts relapse multiple times. Catherine Sayer says that from what she's seen, it can be especially difficult for people trying to get off opioid painkillers because oftentimes, she says, their physical pain overlaps with mental or emotional pain.
Well, I do know that some of the symptoms of depression and anxiety are physical symptoms anyway, without addiction. Depression, some of the symptoms of it are fatigue, body aches, joint pain. And so because depression anyway is so linked to physical symptoms, and then with addiction and painkillers kills that physical pain, they also use it to treat the emotional pain because it numbs the entire brain. It's not selective. It doesn't go in and say, well, I'm only going to numb this part of the brain. It numbs the entire brain. So the part that reads the depression, reads the anxiety, gets numbed as well as the part of the brain that receives receptors of pain.
Oh girl, this boat. What do you think? Do you have someone in your family who struggles or has struggled with addiction? What helped? Do you think medically assisted treatment is necessary for some people? Or do you disagree with this type of treatment? Send us a tweet at In Appalachia, or you can write us an email to feedback@wvpublic.org. Your Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back. No music made, feeling like a failure. And trust me, it's not dope to be 25 and move back to your parents' basement. I see my people's dreams die. I see what they can be denied. And weed's not a drug that's denial. Groundhog Day life repeat each time. I seen Oxycontin take three lives. I grew up with them, we used to cheat dimes. I seen cocaine bring out the demons inside. Cheating and lying, friendship cease, no peace in the mind. Stealing and taking anything to fix the pieces. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're talking about opioid addiction. Opioids are used to treat chronic pain. In the early 1990s, things were quite different when it came to getting help for chronic pain. Opioids were not considered a healthy option because of known addictive qualities. Then, Purdue Pharma released their new drug, called OxyContin. Purdue said this drug was different. It had a time-released formula that didn't create a rush of relief, and therefore, they said, only 1% of the population would become addicted. The FDA agreed with this argument and approved the drug in 1996. Here's a medical doctor speaking about OxyContin in a 1998 promotional video used by Purdue Pharma.
They don't wear out, they go on working. They do not have serious medical side effects. And so these drugs, which I repeat, are our best, strongest pain medications, should be used much more than they are for patients in pain.
Purdue's new drug marked a change in the way doctors treated pain, says Jack Wright. He's the chief of pharmacy at the VA Medical Center in Beckley, West Virginia.
They really started to put the push on this product, OxyContin, which is a long-acting opioid. And they also make a short-acting, which unfortunately has a very high abuse potential to it. It can be crushed, it can be injected, it can be snorted, and unfortunately that took a, you know, this negative turn at that point in time. When that product came on the market, and again, that was the late 90s, early 2000s, that really changed the way pain management was moving. And that started a whole list of new opioids coming to the market, both long-acting and short-acting.
So in the late 90s and early 2000s, it became more common for doctors to treat pain by prescribing opioids like OxyContin. Doctors were told by pharmaceutical companies that it was safe, non-addictive. Around that same time, in the late 1990s, medical associations and doctors introduced the idea that pain should be the fifth vital sign that doctors should be asking their patients. Are you in pain today? just like checking their blood pressure. Dr. Bobby Miller is the Vice Dean for Medical Student Education at Marshall University Joan C. Edwards School of Medicine.
If you're not asking the patient about pain, you might not hear that they have pain. When you start asking about pain, then they tell you, yes, I have pain, and you as a physician feel obligated to do something about it now that you've asked about it. And so the number of opioid prescriptions skyrocketed when pain became a fifth vital sign. The combination of pain being the fifth vital sign and a whole bunch of new pain medicines coming available, the combination together was a bad combination. Physicians felt compelled to treat pain, and now they had a bunch of new medications to do that with.
The concept became increasingly popular in 2001 when the Joint Commission issued its pain management standards, which also called for pain assessment and treatment in 2001 in response to the national outcry about the widespread problem of undertreatment of pain. So basically, thinking about pain is the fifth vital sign. The Joint Commission is an accrediting organization for medical schools across the country. At the beginning of our episode, we heard from Michael Holdren, Kanawha County, West Virginia native, who was injured on the job and became addicted to the pain pills he was legally prescribed. Michael explained how easy it was to doctor shop at some offices years ago when he first became addicted to pain pills.
Because doctors was just giving people prescriptions, getting people hooked. Pills cost too much, and now they're getting low-cost heroin that don't cost anything. That's mixed with everything that's killing people. And it's all coming from doctors. Because doctors, right, I knew a couple doctors, I'd go in and say, my foot hurts, and they gave me a script of pain pills. Mm-hmm. I knew what doctors I could go to get pain pills when I was on pills. That's what people do all the time. You know, they get hooked, they find their doctor that will prescribe no matter what. And that's why it's so bad, because of the doctors. I don't think it's the people. So I think it's more like the doctors need to watch what they're doing and try to help the community by not prescribing just to anybody.
Each person and each addiction story is different. While he does put some blame on doctors, he also admits he did abuse the drugs prescribed to him.
I think that would be the only thing that I would change, is taking them the right way, how you're supposed to take them. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's the same for everybody, but for me, I don't think if I wouldn't have snorted it, I wouldn't have got so addicted. Mm-hmm. Because I was on the meth, and I loved to snort the meth, so I just traded one for the other. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even realize it at the time.
While some doctors have been prosecuted for their role in profiting off of prescriptions, not all doctors were irresponsible in prescribing pain pills. There are several doctors we heard from who work at the New River Health Clinic in Scarborough, West Virginia, who say they've signed a pledge not to start any patient on a combo of opiates and benzodiazepines, like Xanaxes, a dangerous combination of drugs. Dr. Dan Doyle is one of the doctors at the clinic.
One guideline that I try to follow is no chronic daily opiates beyond 8 weeks from an injury.
There are a few things that might help us to understand the challenges for doctors as they try to help their patients. Just how did the medical community get here? Looking back, it seems a lot of the problems could have been avoided, says Janice Lalos, the director of the Charleston Treatment Center.
Well, I think that, well, obviously hindsight is 20/20, and I think that more regulation should have been placed on that. Certainly, individuals knew that the medications being prescribed had addictive qualities.
Her colleague, Catherine Sayer, agrees opioids were and always have been highly addictive.
Heroin is a close cousin pharmaceutically to the prescription narcotics. Morphine, that they've had forever, Dilaudid. People have been addicted to those medications for decades. Why would we not think, and why would the pharmaceutical companies not think that Lortab, you know, the hydrocodones, the oxycodones, are not going to be addictive because they do the same things as these older medications do. So to say, oh, they're not addictive like those, that's just crazy.
But for doctors, treating patients with pain in a fast-paced environment can get complicated. There are times when it's easiest to prescribe a pill, says Dr. Mark McDaniel, the medical director at the Charleston Treatment Center. He also has experience in urgent care.
You know, if you're in a fast-paced ER, you don't have time to try to educate the patients. And a lot of times you just want to get the patients in and out because you have a trauma or something more severe going on. That and it's just easier just to give a, you know, 4 or 5 days worth of opiates and get the patient going so you can see the next person.
McDaniel says it's a delicate balance for doctors and a challenge in the medical community.
If you have a physician that wants to, that says, you know, I'm not going to give you the opiates unless you have a, you know, a broken bone, for instance, or, you know, a documented increase in vital signs that are measured to where you can say that, yes, this person probably has pain and you want to treat that. But for the most part, for me, for instance, you know, in my clinic outside of the addiction clinic, we use, you know, anti-inflammatories and then, or maybe a muscle relaxer if it's more of a muscle spasm, or we're trying to send them to physical therapy or maybe to a chiropractor for treatment.
McDaniel also points to a federal policy that has created a more recent challenge for doctors.
Now we're actually in a hospital. If you have customer service surveys and you know, metrics and so forth, if the patient's not happy with the service, then they can give you a bad score, and that affects your pay. So insurance companies are starting to pay based on patient satisfaction scores. So if the patient wants pain medication and they'll say to the physician, well, if you don't give me the medication, I'm not going to give you a good score. So in order to keep your salary up or your scores up, you give the patient what they want.
While the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare did expand addiction treatment, it also required patient satisfaction surveys in order to qualify for some Medicaid reimbursements. Dr. Bobby Miller with Marshall's Medical School is also a practicing physician. He says patient reviews and evaluations definitely have an effect on the process.
Not because it's not just the doctor. You know, the nurse is recording the pain scale as well. So if there's a bunch of charting from the nurse that the pain scale is in the 4 to 5 range and no intervention, then that does look bad on the doctor.
As for Marshall's Medical School, Miller says they've changed the way they teach students to prescribe pain pills and how to deal with patients abusing pain medications.
Here at Marshall, we have about 30 hours of pain education and prescription education in the first 2 years before they ever get into the clinical years. In the clinical years, we have about 20 hours of scheduled lecture time. That doesn't include all the exposure they get with their individual patient encounters.
Miller says many of the clinical hours in the emergency room include patients requesting opioids. The experiences in clinicals are what's opening the eyes of student doctors the most when it comes to prescribing opioids.
You cannot go through medical school, at least not here at Marshall, without being exposed to pregnant mothers who are drug addicts, adults who come in with addiction issues, and then the newborns who have. So the students get to see these patients in all kinds of settings. And just being exposed and knowing what effect opiates can have on a patient's life, I think changes your mindset more so than what we're teaching them.
So while it seems the medical community is shifting to a different pain management approach, what's being done to prevent doctor shopping? We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear from the West Virginia Board of Pharmacy, which tracks the number of prescriptions being filled in the state. What are they doing to crack down on prescription drug abuse within the medical community? And we'll also hear the next installment of our new series, The Struggle to Stay. That's all coming up in the second half of our show.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today we've been talking about the opioid epidemic in Appalachia. Recently, a reporter from West Virginia won a Pulitzer Prize for his investigative work into the opioid epidemic. Eric Ayer with the Charleston Gazette-Mail investigated the massive amounts of prescription pills that were shipped to certain pharmacies in southern West Virginia. Ayer was featured on a recent episode of the Front Porch Podcast. It's a fascinating conversation. You can check it out on the Front Porch Podcast at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. In taking a closer look at the opioid epidemic on today's show, we've talked about pain as the fifth vital sign and doctor shopping. Last year's Charleston Gazette-Mail reports revealed that millions of pills flooded southern West Virginia. But isn't somebody in charge of regulating all this? Well, the short answer is yes. In West Virginia, the Board of Pharmacy has a tracking system that records all prescriptions filled for opioid pills. It's called the Controlled Substance Monitoring Program, and although most states have one, they don't all work together. There's no system in place that tracks prescriptions from state to state. So someone could get a prescription for OxyContin in, say, Pennsylvania, and their doctor in West Virginia would never know. But what doctors can look up is how many opioids a patient is currently on, at least within the state. West Virginia has actually been tracking narcotics for about 12 years. The Board of Pharmacy is required to keep this information for 5 years. The question is, what happens to this information? Michael Goff is the administrator of the Controlled Substance Monitoring Program at the State Board of Pharmacy, where he's worked for 4 years. Since then, and after a new law, he says there's been some improvement.
In 2012, there was legislation passed that required all practitioners who either prescribe or dispense controlled substances to have an account with us, and some requirement that it's actually utilized if you're treating someone for chronic pain.
The 2012 law he's talking about was West Virginia State Senate Bill 437, which called for a new task force made up of law enforcement, doctors, and pharmacists to review the prescriptions collected in the database. If a patient goes to 12 different doctors and 6 different pharmacies in a 6-month period, Goff says this behavior would be suspicious.
And we would send notifications out to each of the doctors and each of the pharmacies that patient visited, just to make them aware that this is outlying activity and it's potentially a problem, but just to make them aware of it so they can maybe check next time that patient shows up in their office or at their pharmacy.
The point of all this is to cut down on the number of doctor shoppers, folks who are trying to work the system to get doctors to give them more pills, basically, and the number of pill mills, doctors who would write prescriptions solely to make money. And Goff says it's working, at least a little bit. According to the Board of Pharmacy, the number of controlled substance doses West Virginia patients received last year was 12.69 million less than in 2015, and that number has declined by almost 30 million over the past 5 years. The powerful opioid hydrocodone has shown the sharpest decline, with a 40% reduction during the last 5 years. There's also been an increase in the number of doctors and pharmacists using the drug monitoring program to track their patients' prescription of opioids. So we've been talking an awful lot about the challenges of regulating these drugs and keeping opioid abuse under control. But what about those who are suffering from long-term chronic pain? Our producer, Roxy Todd, asked folks through social media to send in their stories. And boy, did you have a lot to say on this issue. We heard from dozens of you, including Aaron Klein, who was injured in a car accident, James McCormick, an Army veteran who was shot several times while in combat, and Jennifer Boyle, who was injured while giving birth to one of her children. Let's listen to what they had to say about living with chronic pain in Appalachia.
I'm 33 years old, and I've been living with chronic pain for about 13 years. It's frustrating because it never goes away. The only time that I'm not in pain is when I'm asleep. Imagine the worst headache you've ever had, one that would make you call in sick to work and stay in bed all day. Now imagine that it never goes away, and you have to live the rest of your life, day in and day out, with that headache. That's what it's like to have chronic pain. Unfortunately, there is a huge opioid abuse problem in West Virginia, and this can further create a barrier for someone with chronic pain. I think often people associate chronic pain patients with someone who is addicted to drugs. And although a chronic pain patient may be physically dependent on the medication they take to control their pain, that doesn't mean they're abusing their medication. I find that massage therapy, physiotherapy, chiropractic care, and even restorative yoga can be helpful. I think it would also be helpful to have a therapist to deal with the stress, anxiety, and depression that can come along with chronic pain. And it can also be really lonely. I think I'm a pretty happy and positive person, but sometimes it's hard to find the energy to be happy and positive when you're in so much pain all the time. If you met me, I don't think you would know that I was in pain all the time unless I told you or we spent a lot of time together. I think people with chronic pain tend to get really good at hiding the fact that they're in pain.
When you have anxiety on top of pain, it makes the pain 10 times worse. And essentially, I was taking a pill to help you sleep, a pill to help you deal with pain, a pill to help you deal with everyday life's ups and downs, your Prozacs and your mood-altering pills is what I would call them. When you started looking at how they interacted with each other, you know, it was potentially dangerous.
Doctors are often telling me that I need to learn to live with it, but yet no one gives me the tools to learn to live with it. It's been very difficult living in West Virginia with chronic pain because most of the doctors don't want to deal with chronic pain patients, and the ones that do are so far away that I have to travel an hour and a half for each monthly appointment. More than anything, I wish people would just remember that there's a lot of us who didn't ask to have chronic pain. We have no say in it, but we do have to live with it. And just counting us in as people who are looking for drugs and forgetting that we have lives and jobs and families, and we'd do anything to have a treatment where we would never have to be considered a chronic pain patient again.
That was Jennifer Boyle, James McCormick, and Aaron Klein telling their stories about chronic pain. You can find a full list of their recommendations for coping with chronic pain on our website at wvpublic.org. Opioid addiction is happening across America. According to the CDC, nearly 2 million Americans either abused or were dependent on prescription opioids in 2014. Still, rates of drug overdose in West Virginia are the highest in the nation. So why has it hit coal country so hard? Well, understanding the level of chronic pain in the region is a good place to start the conversation. A lot of jobs in West Virginia do include tough physical labor that's harder on the body, says Janice Lalos with the Charleston Treatment Center.
We were seeing a lot of individuals who were becoming addicted to pain medication. I think maybe one of the reasons it hit West Virginia particularly hard is we are a large coal mining state. And as such, there are injuries in the coal mines. And so physicians are prescribing these pain medications to their patients to keep them working. And the patients didn't think anything about it. I mean, the doctor gave me this. It's working. I feel great. I'm able to go to work. I'm taking care of my family. And then it got so bad that then when those individuals had to go off of those medications, they found it extremely difficult and they realized they were addicted to it.
But even when people don't take opioids for their pain, many take over-the-counter medications on a regular basis, which can also have long-term effects on the body, says Denisio Ruby, chief of medicine at the Clarksburg VA Medical Center.
What we face as specifically in our state in West Virginia is blue-collar workers. So brother-in-laws, people who are working in the mines or electricians who are construction workers, not necessarily Washington, D.C., in which maybe they may have more of the white-collar population. So these patients that we see on a regular basis have put their bodies through significant difficult situations, and they put it, tested to the limits, and at younger ages they're taking normal medications, Tylenol and ibuprofen, but on a regular basis.
What Ruby is mentioning there, taking acetaminophen, ibuprofen, is part of a culture of hard physical work that Appalachians have been doing for generations, that's been around for longer than the opioid epidemic, doing what you need to do to get through your day.
There's all right, guys. Everybody had their own little problems, but they're all good people, just had problems. You know, like you said, blue-collar people, you know, we're out here busting our butts. We're out here making good money. We're out here keeping your lights on. Things happen, and some things you just can't control.
That's Michael Holdren, the man we heard from earlier, who says he got addicted to pain pills following a workplace accident.
The pain pills gave me the up that I needed to get through the day.
Michael says his injury, a smashed hand with a 12-pound sledgehammer resulting in 4 broken bones, wasn't considered serious on the oil rig.
I would say that that's got a lot to do with it. Who's the toughest out there? I'm tougher than you are. That kind of thinking. That's probably a lot of male testosterone going on out there.
Michael was laid off from his job on the oil rig, and eventually he lost everything.
Like, after I got my divorce, I lived with my grandma. She passed away, and then I was so bad I didn't have a home, didn't have a car, I didn't have anything. All I had was money for child support just to keep myself out of jail, and my drugs. I'd always have money for drugs somehow, but that was life. That was living, waking up every day. You either have it or you don't. And if you don't, you're not going to have a good day. And even if you do, you're not having a good day. But in your mind, you think you're having a good day because the drugs are making you think you're having a good day.
Like most recovering addicts, for Michael, getting clean took several attempts.
My grandma, right before she passed away, she asked me to get clean. And I tried. I went to a Highland detox. And at that time, me and my ex-wife was talking and maybe was going to get back together. But I went and put myself in Highland Detox thinking if I did, that she would, you know, be back with me. And I went to the Highland Detox. I was there for 10 days, the maximum that they'll let you stay there. It's a 7 to 10 day program. And I got out, and she done found somebody else and got remarried and everything, but I stayed clean for like 2 months after that, and my grandpa passed away in front of me. And hospice had him on a lot of pain pills, a lot of pain medication, liquid morphine, Oxycontin, and Percocets, Lortabs. He passed away. I got into his drawer and took his pills and relapsed. Because I knew hospice was coming to take them and flush them down the toilet. So I went and got them. So it was just like in a flash, I relapsed after going 2 months without anything. Just knowing that they was there, you know, seeing what I just seen.
It's hard.
It was hard. And I went probably, after that trial, I went probably another year. And I went to Prestera and Dunbar.
The clinic in Dunbar, he says, gave him Suboxone, which is a combination of buprenorphine and naloxone. The first time Michael took it, he was surprised.
I wasn't high. I wasn't, you know, sick. I just felt normal. I just felt like myself again. And it made me to the point where I could actually do things with my kids, with myself. Get my act together. You know, I'm not out here spending thousands of dollars on pills.
Suboxone is different from other addiction treatment medications. While it does contain an opioid substitute, it's mixed with the opioid antidote, naloxone, which makes Suboxone harder to abuse. The more you take, the less high you get. Back in 2012, the maker of Suboxone announced that they would stop producing the drug in pill forms. So Michael couldn't snort his medications this time. The Suboxone was helping him to live a normal life until he was kicked out of the program at Dunbar when he failed a drug test for marijuana. So he called the Charleston Treatment Clinic. He's been in treatment here for almost 3 years.
It made me to the point where I could actually do things with my kids, with myself, get my act together. You know, I'm not out here spending thousands of dollars on pills that, you know, I know that if I would have kept spending that much money on pills, it would have turned up to being heroin. That's when I wanted it to stop, because my kids need me. And I think that's the main thing that's gotten me through this, is myself, first of all, and my kids. I've done this myself. And my kids give me all the support I need. And the people up here are pretty good. My counselor is good. You got to make time for yourself. You can't worry about other people or anything else. Because if you do, you're not, you know, you can't focus on the bad things and have the good things happen.
Getting clean, finding sobriety, and the opioid epidemic is a struggle and battle that we're all familiar with in some way. And it will take each of us doing our part to win this fight for our loved ones and our communities. Here's treatment specialist Dr. Mark McDaniel again.
This is another misconception that your typical appearance of a drug addict is somebody that has lots of tattoos, that has a leather jacket, but what you don't see is the school teachers, the lawyers, the doctors, the business owners, you know, the PTA mom that maybe had a C-section and was put on pain medications, or somebody that had a back pain and was put on for a short term of pain medications and suddenly has that addiction. And so they're hiding it from society because of the negative view that addiction has. I think that we as a society need to quit looking upon the people that have the drug addiction as a negative thing, because you don't see the people that are your neighbor or your teacher and so forth that have that addiction. And instead of looking down upon, we need to reach out and say, hey, listen, I understand you have addiction. How can I help you? Do you need support? Those kind of things.
The fight isn't over, and neither is the conversation here on Inside Appalachia. Next week, we're talking about another population that's vulnerable to opioid addiction, veterans. We'll talk to veterans like Adam Smith, who suffers from chronic pain after serving in the Army, but he's finding a way through the pain without a pill.
I went from, you know, golden child, doing everything right, to, oh my gosh, you're hurt, you're having problems, you're a piece of shit all of a sudden. The military cannot tolerate weakness as a culture. We're warriors. We get stuff done. There's got to be a better way to treat people that have been hurt from service. It's going to happen. It's an occupational hazard. Logistically speaking, there's a better way to deal with, you know, this many people that are hurt and that have problems. I'm so happy that the VA has embraced yoga, and I'd like to see them embrace it more. You know, without a pill, you can feel better. I mean, that's pretty powerful. And you can calm yourself down and feel so much better without taking a pill, without relying on somebody else doing something to you. Yoga, you're moving your own body.
That's next week, Inside Appalachia. Today we've been listening to an encore episode of Inside Appalachia that first aired earlier this year in April. We close this week's show with the next installment of The Struggle to Stay. Last week we met Crystal Snyder, a single mother of two who says she wants to stay in West Virginia and raise her children here. But she worries about the high rates of substance abuse and studies that show people in her area of Central Appalachia have a lower life expectancy. So she questions whether staying here is really what's best for her kids.
Is it a good idea for me to leave my children here? Like, part of me wants to take them out so they don't die 15 years, you know, premature.
As a single mom, it's on Crystal to provide for a family, which is hard to do without a job. A couple years ago, she lost her job at the T-shirt factory. That's where Roxy Todd picks back up with Crystal's struggle to stay story.
In October of 2015, Crystal lost her job. She takes me to the factory where she used to work. It's a plain gray building that's grim on the outside.
There were no women that ran the machines, and so I kind of raised hell because I wanted to run a machine. You know, I wanted to make more money. I wanted to have more responsibility here.
Crystal says the men earn more pay at the T-shirt factory, but it was more than the money that bothered her.
I was just kind of bored catching shirts down at the end of the dryer, so I wanted to do something else, and it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way that no women were operators.
She's always thought of herself as a tough person, and she's proud of her strength. She isn't afraid to do work that men typically do.
I kind of like non-traditional, or like men's jobs. Maybe it's a pride thing, I don't know. I like physical jobs. I like jobs that people might be surprised that they might see me doing, or I don't know, I just like to be different.
Crystal asked to be promoted to work the machines, but her supervisor told her no and didn't consider her for a different job. She didn't file a discrimination suit against the company for that or for the sexual harassment she says she endured at the factory.
it just seems like there wasn't a lot of respect. Like, hey, your butt looks good in those jeans, or just perverted harassment.
Crystal didn't complain because she figured it would just make things worse if she wanted to keep her job. But one thing she didn't tolerate at the factory was racism. Some of her coworkers put up giant rebel flags on their trucks and said racist things. Crystal is white, but when the racism went unchecked, it bothered her.
I was like all I could take, and I just went to the boss and I was like, this isn't right. You know, this is not a good environment to work in. And it was like a week or two later, the boss came to me and said like that business had slowed down and that he was going to lay me off. And I was like, it's because I complained. He's like, no, that doesn't have anything to do with it.
Even though she still believed she was unfairly terminated, she didn't seek legal counsel after she lost her job at the t-shirt factory. She didn't want to get anyone in trouble, and she didn't want to deal with the stress of courts and lawyers. Because none of this was resolved in court, and since the company went out of business in 2016, we're withholding the name of the company where she worked. After she was laid off, money was tight. Crystal got behind on some of her bills. During the holidays, she got help from her ex to buy a few presents for her kids.
They had something, but yeah, it was definitely a tough Christmas.
Still, she tried not to worry and stayed busy looking for work. This wasn't the first time she had to figure out how to survive as a single mom. She'd struggled 3 years earlier, right after she divorced her second husband. It was a brief marriage, and things ended abruptly.
I just found myself like, I've got rent and bills, and I've got to buy food and gas. Like, how am I going to do this? You know, I went from having help, like we'd split all the bills and everything and the food and everything, to just totally me. And it was really scary. And I remember like the house felt like dark and cold.
Although the t-shirt factory eventually became, as she puts it, a toxic place to work, she was happy for the money. Still, she says she's glad she isn't working there anymore.
I'm thankful for the job, but it wasn't a happy place. It wasn't someplace that I wanted to stay. But I didn't really know what I would do. I thought maybe when the kids grew up, then maybe I could go to college and do something. I didn't know what. But I was just trying to keep the bills paid, you know, and just try to be happy for them and do things on the weekends and just keep things going.
After she lost her job at the t-shirt factory, she kept faith that she would find another job. And she did.
A friend knew I got laid off, and he sent me a link that they were doing offering free job training classes at in Huntington.
The job training workshop was through a nonprofit called Coalfield Development Corporation. When she was at the class, she heard they were hiring for a new farmer training program.
And that's how I found Refresh Appalachia, so I'm happy I got laid off.
By the way, remember Colt Brogan from our earlier Struggle to Stay series? He and Crystal actually work together. Like Colt, Crystal spends a lot of her time working at an old farm in Milton that sits right beside Interstate 64. There's an old gray barn with a giant American flag, a tiny green farmhouse where they have work meetings on the porch. One of the best parts about the job, for Crystal, is that she's treated as an equal and gets to do the same work as the men. Crystal was beaming one afternoon last summer when she told me her boss, Ben Gilmer, taught her to drive a John Deere tractor.
Ben and I worked together this past Sunday, and he was very patient, and he taught me how to drive it. And he believed in me and told me to get up there, and I did, and I plowed half that field there. It was awesome. I'm proud to be in the field of agriculture. I'm proud to be on this journey, and I don't know where it's going, but it's going somewhere good.
The program also requires participants to go to school. It's been about 7 years since Crystal was in a classroom. When she got married at 16, she dropped out of high school and ended up getting her GED 3 years later. She took a couple of college courses, but going to school, while working, and raising two kids, it was just too much, and she eventually dropped out of college. But getting a job that helps her go to college was a game changer.
That associate degree, like that's what I've got my eye on. Like just the fact that I can earn an associate degree in 2 years and earn half of my credits while I'm working. And I'm also getting paid a stipend while I'm at class. So like that's just huge, you know, like one class is hard. I can imagine trying to take two and work, you know, full time. I don't think I could do it. So this is the way I can. And I don't want to stop with the associate degree. I want to keep going. I want to get a master's degree.
But before she gets there, she has to pass her classes. And that's been challenging.
The hardest thing is balancing it all. 33 hours, like working full time and going to school full time, still taking care of a house and a yard and kids and dinner. I don't want to be negative, but I don't know if it's possible. No, I forget that. It's possible.
A few months after she began working with Coalfield Development and started her first semester of college, it became more and more difficult to find time to spend with her two kids, Morgan and Aaron.
I can't focus on like learning if I know my kids are bored or, you know, they need my attention. That's the hardest part.
She's also been struggling financially. And though she loves her job, she makes less money than she did at the t-shirt factory.
My bank account, it's negative $515.98, which is pretty normal. I just had to pay the rent, so it kind of goes with my story.
In June of 2016, Crystal started her first semester of college. She's taking an English class, which she loves because she's learning to write. But it's a summer class, which means it only lasts 5 weeks. Can she finish all her assignments on time while balancing all her other responsibilities? More next time. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Cabell County, West Virginia.
We'll continue Crystal's struggle to stay story next week on Inside Appalachia. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the Inside Appalachia podcast and listen on your own time. You can find the show on iTunes, Downcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe on our website and see photos and learn more about the series. That's at wvpublic.org. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Larry Dowling, Ben Townsend, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, and Heroes Are Gang Leaders. Patrick Stevens is our audio mixer. Roxy Todd helped produce. We also had help from West Virginia Public Broadcasting reporter Clark Davis and Eric Newhouse. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. He also edited our show this week. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.